Well, let me begin, of course, by thanking the organisers of the meeting for asking me along to talk to you today, and also thank the ITP. I've been here for a couple of weeks, and as always, it's a wonderful place to work, pleasant location, and of course, the support staff are extremely helpful. Today, I want to talk about the prospect of quantum computing from the point of view of how you would actually read out a quantum computer in a solid-state system. We are faced with this problem in a very particular form in our attempt to build a Kane architecture quantum computer in the Centre for Quantum Computer Technology in Australia. In the Kane architecture, you may recall, the objective is to read out a single spin by transforming spin information into essentially charge information and then trying to detect a charge transfer with either a single some sort of single electron device, such as a radio frequency single electron transistor. Let me first acknowledge my collaborators on this. There's Dr. Goen, who's a postdoc at the University of Queensland, Herbie Soon, a postdoc at the University of Queensland, and Howard Wiseman, who's a lecturer at Griffith University. What is the connection between qubits and measurement? Well, let me just begin by making a few general comments, and the first one I think that we should take note of is that it is simply not possible to define a qubit independent of the means by which it will be read out. You can come up with the most marvelous schemes of qubits and coupling between qubits and so on, but if you can't see it, there's little point in pursuing it. So measurement has to be considered alongside the very definition of a qubit in a quantum computer. But there are a number of other issues where the measurement problem enters directly. And the second is, to determine the true decoherence time or the true dephasing time of a couple qubit system, you need to be able to turn the measurement off and on. Otherwise, what you tend to get is a convolution of the decoherence time due to the measurement itself and the intrinsic decoherence time of the device. What you'd really like to do is to let the device itself or some couple spin system evolve for some fixed period of time and then take a snapshot readout at that point and then repeat that over and over and over again for different readout times and slowly construct some kind of oscillatory probability to find, for example, the qubit in a logical zero state. Then from that data, you can infer the dephasing time as some overall decay. And finally, for accurate readout and possibly error correction or some other kind of control protocol where you need to make accurate measurements and then use that information to change the future state of the system, you will also need to have extremely fast and accurate readout of the quantum computer. So that's some motivation for considering in detail the measurement problem in the context of a solid-state quantum computer. Just to fix the discussion a little bit, I want to put up this particular model, which is what I have in mind as I'm doing this. There are many other ways you could imagine implementing a qubit in a solid-state system. It could be nuclear spin in phosphorus, embedded in silicon, for example, or many, many other schemes. The two I'm going to have at the back of my mind is the simple scheme where you have a phosphorus ion, which is ionized, and another phosphorus ion next to it, which has a donor electron bound to it. So this is like, it's a bit like a H2 plus molecule in some ways. There are two ionic cores and one electron shared between them. Essentially, it's a single electron double dot system where the electron can tunnel between one location and the other. So this is a sort of schematic picture where this is the valence band edge of silicon. This is the bent conduction band edge in silicon due to two embedded phosphorus ions. And then there are these shallow donor states, grossly exaggerated. They should be up much closer to the conduction band of the single electron on those donor sites. Or you could imagine a device defined in some sort of surface gate device defined in a two-dimensional electron gas in some heterostructure along the lines that David DiVincenzo and Daniel Loss have discussed in the past. So that's the sort of basic idea I have at the back of my mind when I'm talking about these measurement models. And the objective could be, for example, to determine, is the electron on this ion or on this ion, or, depending on how you measure it, is it in the symmetric ground state or the antisymmetric first excited state? So in fact, how you define the qubit in this system rather depends on what you can measure. For example, if you can actually measure in the energy basis, perhaps through some Raman scheme of exciting from the symmetric ground state, or perhaps the anti-symmetric first excited state, then you could define your qubits either as the symmetric ground state or one as the anti-symmetric state. On the other hand, if you actually can measure charge separation in this system, is the electron on the left or the right donor, then it might be more sensible to look at localized states, which are symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of the energy eigenstates of the total system. Which of these you would use in practice depends, of course, on the measurement, but on other things as well. There is perhaps some advantage in using these states because they have pretty much the same charge distribution, whereas these states have a very different charge distribution and would couple very differently to environmental fluctuations due to charge states at trap sites. So there are other issues besides the measurement one that might determine how you actually code your qubit in a solid state system, but I'll only be talking about measurement. Okay, I want to just spend the next 10 minutes or so talking about continuous measurement in a more general context. There are a number of simple ideas which I would like to outline first before going on to look at a very detailed model using a point contact for readout of a solid state 2-qubit device. Well, as we all know, a measured system is an open system. Of course, not every open system can be considered as some sort of measurement device, but certainly a measured system is an open system. There is some sort of reversible interaction involved, which enables you to correlate the states of some pointer variable to the states of the actual measured system. And there's also some irreversible interaction involved, because the apparatus itself is some kind of macroscopic object, typically, or at very least, is coupled to many degrees of freedom in the environment. In fact, it's the nature of the coupling between that pointer degree of freedom and the many degrees of freedom in the environment which actually defines the kind of measurement device you have. There's a very intimate connection between decoherence and the way in which the pointer is coupled to the environment and the very means to define this as, say, a measurement device of charge or position or whatever. And of course, Wojciech Żurek has written some very nice papers pointing out that it's the interaction between the pointer and the environment which actually defines the kind of measurement apparatus that you are using. So schematically, we have some measured system. It's coupled directly to some degree of freedom in a system which has a large number of degrees of freedom called the apparatus and a particular degree of freedom called the pointer. But of course, the details can get rather messy, and it's sometimes very difficult to take a particular measurement scheme and split it down in quite that form. In any case, in every measurement scheme that you might wish to analyze, there are at least two questions that you need to take account of. Firstly, from the point of view of an experimentalist, it makes sense to ask the question, what is the state of the measured system given a particular measurement record? These kinds of questions have become increasingly important over the last decade or so as we've gained access to single quantum systems that can be prepared in pure states and then continuously interrogated over time. In that context, in order to make sense of the time series of the measurement result, it's essential to ask the question, what is the state of the quantum system conditioned on a particular measurement record, which could be discrete or it could be continuous? On the other hand, taking the view that a measured system is an open system, we could simply average over all possible measurement results and regard the coupling to the apparatus as simply some sort of environmental effect leading to decoherence and possibly energy dissipation. In that case, we could ask the question, what is the state of the measured system averaged over all measurement results? And I'll refer to that as unconditional dynamics. So there are these two perspectives that one can take on a measurement scheme. Of course, one also has to take account of what the actual measurement record is, because after all, that's what the experimentalist has access to. And that, of course, is purely classical, as it must always be. As I think I saw on a slide yesterday, you have classical bits in and classical bits out in a sort of big fuzzy cloud in the middle. But at the end of the day, it's classical information either in the computer or on your notebook or whatever that we're actually going to analyze and talk about. Of course, we infer that there's something a bit spooky in that fuzzy cloud by comparing the input and output strings, be they classical or not, and it's the correlations between the input and the output, of course, which lead us to infer that there's something quantum going on in between. So let me now define a little bit more carefully what I mean by a true quantum limited measurement, because clearly not all measurements are quantum limited. In fact, most measurements up until fairly recently, to even ask the question of what is the role of quantum mechanics in determining the signal-to-noise ratio would be rather pointless, because it has very little role in determining the signal-to-noise ratio. So I'll define a quantum limited measurement in this way. It certainly doesn't capture completely what is meant in every case, but it's a good place to start. So a quantum limited measurement is one for which the signal-to-noise ratio, that is some measure of the quality of the measurement, is determined only by, one, the intrinsic quantum noise of the measured system, that is, you have direct access to the intrinsic statistics of the state you're trying to examine, and furthermore, that the minimum back action noise consistent with the uncertainty principle also determines the signal-to-noise ratio. So as you extract information from the system, of course, you add noise to it, through some manifestation of the uncertainty principle, and we'd like to think that was the only amount of noise, the only way in which noise was added back into the system. Of course, that is very rarely the case in general. There are many sources of noise for some given system, and certainly for solid-state systems. That's a major problem. If both those things are satisfied, as I'll shortly show, then the decoherence rate is determined only by the back-action noise due to the measurement. So this is, in fact, just an example of complementarity. If the back action noise is the minimum amount consistent with the uncertainty principle, then the system will decohere in the conjugate basis. A simple example, as I've said, to keep in mind is imagining some simple two-state system, which could, for example, be coupled to a continuous degree of freedom. There are a number of proposals to read out the state of a single electronic qubit using some sort of mechanical oscillator, an electromechanical system, some sort of magnetic resonance force microscopy, which is essentially a simple harmonic oscillator with continuous degrees of freedom coupled to a system with a two-dimensional Hilbert space. The measurement result is then a stochastic sequence of real numbers, which could, for example, represent the displacement of the oscillator amplitude at particular measurement times t sub I. Well, rather than going into the gory details of some complicated nano-electromechanical system, let me just give you a simple model which captures the basic idea. In describing a measurement, we of course would have recourse to the method of operations and effects, or positive operator valued measures, or whatever you want to call it. Generally they seem to be known by the name of Krauss operator these days. So I'm going to define this measurement of a spin half system, or any two-level system for that matter, in terms of this Krauss operator, which has some resolution delta, but the measurement result is some real number x. And it depends upon the measured variable. In fact, this commutes with the measured variable, which in this case is sigma z, which could be the Pauli matrix in the qubit basis. Then the probability for a particular measurement result at time t is just taken by the trace of the state of the spin half system, or two-dimensional system at time t, over the positive operator value measure that this Krauss operator defines. And then you can quickly calculate the moments to show that the classical expectation value of this distribution is just some scaled quantum expectation value of the measured quantity, as you would hope. And the uncertainty is determined by, well, the uncertainty in the variable you're trying to measure, that's the intrinsic quantum uncertainty in the measured system, plus some added noise coming from the apparatus itself. So we can go a little bit further and write that Krauss operator out in a slightly more intuitive. Let's get the hand out of the way. Oh, that was a mistake. In this form, and you can see it's just a projection onto the eigenstates of sigma z, and there's some conditional probability distribution out the front, which is essentially a displaced Gaussian, and the separation between these Gaussians depends on the parameter kappa, or more particularly, the ratio of kappa to delta. So kappa determines the position spacing of this distribution, and delta determines their width, so for good measurement you'd like them to be well spaced and quite narrow. You can then talk about what the conditional state of the measured system is given a particular result by acting on it with the Krauss operators. So that would be an answer to the conditional question, what is the state of the system given a particular result x at time t. You can then go on to look at a continuous measurement model. And there are various ways to do this. Here's one way. We just imagine that these particular Gaussian irresolution operators act at Poisson distributed times. You could have them act at discrete times and then take some continuous limit. or various other processes, but this is a simple way to actually do it, then if you average over all the times at which those operators can act and all the possible measurement results, then the unconditional evolution of the system is given by this master equation, which is relatively easy to derive for this Poisson process. I'm assuming that the rates at which the measurement occur is just some fixed rate gamma and does not depend on any properties of the system or the measuring device itself. Then you can actually do these integrals and you discover that you get a double commutator with respect to the measured operator, as you would expect, because it should decohere in the basis sigma z of the measured operator. Now at the front here we have something that depends upon the quality of the measurement and the rate at which information is being obtained in this system, gamma. So for a very good measurement, or perhaps I should say a very poor measurement, for a very poor measurement, this quantity here would be close to 1, so this would be practically 0. In fact, if kappa is 0, there's no measurement at all in this model, and the system doesn't decohere at all. In the other extreme, where these resolution Gaussians are well separated, this quantity just decoheres at a constant rate, gamma, determined by the rate at which information is coming in. But that's not the whole story, of course. What I want to do now is talk about the actual measurement record. That's, if you like, the unconditional dynamics of the system. I'd now like to specify, in some sense, what is the actual measurement record? Well, let me take a limit of very weak, rapid measurements. So we imagine these measurements are very, very poor. They're lousy measurements, but there's a lot of them. So the, if you like, the bandwidth of the measurement is very high, but the noise is quite large in any given measurement. So we're going to take the rate at which the measurements occur, gamma very, very large. One means compared to some intrinsic dynamics in the actual free Hamiltonian of the system. But the noise is quite large compared to the amplification or coupling constant, if you like, between the spin system and the apparatus. Then you get this simplified equation where there's some single parameter, the decoherence parameter, which would be large if this measurement was very good, as I'll shortly show. So if D was large in some sense, it would rapidly decohere in the eigenbasis of the measured quantity sigma z. In the same way we took that limit, we can define now the measurement record. The measurement record is actually a sequence of real numbers, x, at Poisson distributed times t. So we can define this stochastic differential here, dy of t, which is the product of a point process times the actual measurement result at time t. So this quantity here is either 0 or 1 if a particular measurement acts at some interval of time t to t plus delta t. And if it does act, this just gives you a particular value at that time. So this, if you like, is just a sequence of points at Poisson distributed times, and the value at each of those points is the actual measurement result, x of t. So, as I said before, the point process itself is defined to be completely independent of the state of the system, which is some constant rank gamma. You can then take what I'll call the diffusive limit. So I imagine that on some timescale delta t, which is short compared to the rate at which information is coming out of this system, long compared to the rate at which information is coming out of this system, but very short compared to the intrinsic unconditional dynamics of the system itself, so that there are many, many, many measurements in a time delta t, but the system itself hardly changes in a time delta t, then you can take a diffusive limit and essentially describe the observed process by this continuous stochastic process, essentially a diffusion process. But the important point I want to make is when you scale it correctly, you see that the noise enters as the inverse of, the root inverse of the decoherence rate. So for a good measurement, where the signal-to-noise ratio is very good, you'd like D to be very large so that you're getting access to the intrinsic properties of the measured system and the effect of noise is quite small. And that, of course, is the same limit in which the system rapidly decoheres, as you would expect. So this sets up the picture in which we can see what good quantum limited measurement corresponds to in terms of a measurement record and how it influences the decoherence of the measured system. So let me now go on to look at a particular system in rather more detail. Well, first let me just summarize that. So here's the system dynamics with some decoherence rate d, and here's the measurement signal, which has some added noise that scales becomes smaller as the decoherence rate becomes larger. Now, of course, in reality, there's a lot more to it than that. There may be many other deeper hearing channels, noise or dissipation or whatever, tucked away there. Plus the fact the signal itself may be contaminated by many sources of noise, not just the intrinsic noise coming out of the actual measured system itself, or some intrinsic noise associated with a particular pointed degree of freedom. So in reality, there are many, many other parameters that would figure, but this is just a simple example of a quantum limited measurement. Now let me go on to look at a very specific measurement proposal in more detail. Let me now return to the idea of having a double quantum dot. So for example, this could be two phosphorus donors with a single electron which is tunneling coherently backwards and forwards between dot one and dot two. And the objective of this is to determine whether the electron is on dot one or dot two. To do that, we imagine that our apparatus is in fact a point contact. This is some sort of mesoscopic conducting channel with a little pinch-off region with a barrier. And that barrier height can be raised or lowered depending upon the electrostatic interaction with this dot. So we imagine that if the electron is on this dot, somehow or other this barrier is raised and the conductance of this channel is changed, maybe completely turned off, for example. On the other hand, if the electron is over here, then these electrons can tunnel quite happily through this point contact. This is meant to indicate some Fermi reservoir of electrons maintained in local thermodynamic equilibrium by connection to an external circuit with chemical potential mu sub L. And likewise on this side, the whole thing is not in thermodynamic equilibrium. There's some imbalance between the chemical potentials which reflects some overall electrical bias of the system. So this is an intrinsically open system. It has many, many degrees of freedom. There are lots of electrons here, and these are fermionic reservoirs. And of course, that's essential for defining the kind of measurement this is going to be in the first place. So, if you like, here's the measured system. The pointer variable is just the number of electrons that tunnel in some time t, and the environment is the interaction of those tunneling electrons with the mesoscopic reservoirs in the left and the right leads or ohmic contacts. Now we get down to the gory details and start writing down the Hamiltonian. All these operators are fermion creation and annihilation operators. So we have a Hamiltonian that describes the double dot system. This is the number operator for electrons in dot one, number operator for electrons in dot two. In fact, I'll be restricting it to only one electron. So in fact, the eigenvalues of these things are only one and zero. Then there's a tunnel coupling between the two dots. Then there's the free electrons for the left reservoir and the right reservoir. This is the free Hamiltonian for those large systems. Then there's a tunnel coupling from the left to the right reservoir involving many modes of the fermionic fields. And finally, there's the coupling between the actual quantum dot system and the measuring device, which if you compare it to this term, you see it's pretty much the same as a tunneling term, but it's turned on or off depending on whether the number of electrons in dot one is zero or one. So T, if you like, represents the bare tunneling rate of this point contact, and chi times the number of electrons in dot one will modulate that tunneling rate in some way. Well, you can then churn through in the usual way. I guess it's the usual way, but the standard thing would be to treat the reservoirs as some kind of, Markov reservoirs, and eliminate their description from the explicit dynamics, leaving you with an intrinsic dynamics for the measured system alone, that is the double dot system. So this is the unconditional dynamics of the whole thing. So there's some coherent dynamics, and now we have this dissipative operator defined with a jump operator and a normalizing operator in the usual way. In fact, these are just the Lindblad type operators. But it depends upon an operator T, which is essentially just the bare tunneling rate through the point contact. In fact, this is just T, just a number times the identity operator, plus a term that depends upon the number of electrons in dot one. So that hides a lot of the details, but you can get to the details pretty quickly just by calculating the unconditional dynamics through the matrix elements of the double dot system. You can look in the populations in each dot, and you can look in the coherences. The populations depend upon the tunneling coherence of the system, and the coherence itself depends upon a possible energy mismatch between the two dots, depends upon the tunneling. But the point I want to make here is it depends critically on the coupling to the fermionic reservoir at a rate pi. That's the decoherence rate. And that depends only upon the coupling constant between the dot and the reservoirs. It doesn't depend upon the bare tunneling rate through the dot. So in this system, that is the decoherence rate. But of course, we'd like to actually look at the measured signal in this system. So there are a number of ways of doing it, but let me take one particular approach of defining in a current through the system, which is just the charge E times the rate of change of this point process representing electrons tunneling through the system. Now, of course, in reality, that would have to be convoluted with some response function because you're not going to see delta function spikes in any real circuit. Every time an electron tunnels across, it will have some finite effect in the actual macroscopic leads on the system. But let's just take that as the simplest case. That is a conditional point process. It's a purely classical process, but it's conditioned on the quantum source that's driving it through this equation. The average value of that point process is given by the trace of this Lindblad jump operator over the instantaneous conditional state of the system. And from that you can derive that the average current is given by, well, I put in some little efficiency here, which means that not every electron that tunnels gives some finite effect in the actual current. But for simplicity, we could just set that to 1. And it depends upon two numbers. It depends upon D, which is the bare tunneling rate through the device, because there could be some tunneling rate through the device regardless of whether or not the dot is connected at all, plus some change in the tunneling rate conditioned on the average number of electrons in dot 1. So this quantity here, the bare tunneling rate, is just T squared, but the conditional tunneling rate depends on the coupling constant chi. And in general, there could be some phase dependence entering here, which has a number of effects. Obviously, the very best case you'd like is that when the dot is occupied, the tunneling is turned off completely. That would be a very clear-cut measurement of whether or not dot 1 was occupied. So in that case, these would come in with opposite phase and would have equal magnitude. So in some sense, we'd expect a good measurement to correspond to unit quantum efficiency, this conditional tunneling rate going to 0, and in that case, the signal is determined completely by D, which in fact turns out to be just chi squared, which is just the decoherence rate. So once again, there's a close connection between the decoherence rate and the actual size of the signal. There are a number of ways of analyzing further what the signal is. The simplest thing would be to take the noise power spectrum, which you can get from the master equation formalism using essentially a version of the quantum regression theorem. This is the noise power spectrum of the current two-time correlation function. You see it depends upon the difference between these two tunneling rates, the bare tunneling rate and the conditional tunneling rate. So you'd like that to be large. It depends upon the decoherence rate. It depends upon, of course, the tunneling, the coherent tunneling rate between the two dots, dot 1 and 2, because as the electron tunnels between dot 1 and 2, it's essentially modulating in some way the current through the point contact. And this noise power spectrum picks that up. If the tunneling rate is big enough, you should actually see two peaks in the spectrum. On the other hand, if the tunneling rate is small, then you just see this Lorentzian spectrum at the origin. We can now go on to ask, what is the dynamics of the system given a particular measurement record? And I'd like to do this because there's another constant that we need to know to describe the quality of this measurement, and that is, how fast does the system localize on one eigenstate or the other of the measured quantity? We intuitively expect that if you measure sigma z, it should end up in an eigenstate of sigma z. At least for a single-shot projective measurement, that would be true. For these weak continuous measurements, we have to be a little bit more cautious about what that rate would be. So as I said before, the classical average of this conditional point process depends upon the instantaneous state of the system. We can then derive a conditional master equation, and I'm not going to go through the details of this. There are many derivations now in the quantum optics literature, have been around for about 6 or 7 years. There are very few in the condensed matter literature. Typically in condensed matter systems, people are not so much interested in the local system, the quantum dot system. They're interested in what's coming in and what's coming out. So in that case, Green's function methods are more popular. But from a quantum computing context, we really want to talk about the dynamics of the actual local system, not the input and output statistics. Of course, there's a close connection between them. But these conditional systems do enable you to talk about the conditional dynamics of the actual measured system. So here we have a conditioning term, which can be either 0 or 1. If it's 1, this tells you how the system changes when an electron tunnels through the point contact. And there's another term which represents, if you like, what happens when there's no jump, which renormalizes the probability, because if you don't see a jump, then it becomes increasingly likely you will see a jump. If you average over all the measurement results, then of course if you look at the conditional population difference between the two dots, you just see a typical dephasing decay of the Rabi oscillation between the two dots. But if you look at the conditional dynamics, you see this rather spiky looking process, where here's the actual observed stochastic process of the jumps, and every time it jumps, of course, it tends to jump back to dot 2, renormalizing this back to probability 1. Because if an electron tunnels across, it's more likely that the electron wasn't in the dot nearest the point contact. You can then calculate this quantity, the average value with a conditional square of the population difference, which is not something you can get from the unconditional master equation, simply because the square of the Pauli operator is 1. You can only get this from the conditional equation. And you discover that the rate at which it tends to localize on one dot or the other is given by this quantity, which in the limit of a good measurement that I defined before essentially becomes a decoherence rate. So the rate at which the system zeroes in on a particular eigenvalue depends upon the decoherence rate, as you would expect. You can also take a diffusive limit in this system, which essentially means there's lots of tunneling events, and the effect of tunneling due to the dot is very, very small. I won't go into the details once again, but you can write down a diffusive conditional master equation this time, not a jump process, and you can once again calculate the dynamics of the conditional population difference. It's now a diffusion process, there's some tunneling term, and this diffusion process you see has a white noise term driving it, but as the system tends towards a value of plus or minus 1, so that this squared is 1, the noise term turns off and the system localizes on one state or the other. So from that you can see that the localization rate is essentially determined once again by the decoherence rate for the measured system. So here's just a quick picture of the passage from jump dynamics to diffusive dynamics, and this is the case where a noise power spectrum would enable you to identify the Rabi oscillations between the two dots. Okay, I don't have a lot of time left to talk about quantum control. There are various aspects of quantum control and feedback. One is the situation where on the basis of measurement results, you take that data and do something to the system or some other system. In many ways, that's just local operations with classical communication. What I'm more interested in is the case where the control is done without measurement, where there is an irreversible control between a source system with some coherent dynamics and a receiver system with some coherent dynamics, but the coupling is irreversible. There are many, many degrees of freedom outside here. Some particular degrees of freedom carry information from the source to the receiver, but not back the other way. So it's not coherent coupling, it's an incoherent coupling, but there's no measurement result. This, for example, in this example of Serac and Zola and others, represents an output coupling field from an optical cavity, but it could, for example, as I'll show in a minute, be a single electron in a ballistic channel. So this is the case typically considered in quantum optics, where we have a source system and a receiver system. There's some coherent control of an atom inside a cavity, and that information is then carried across irreversibly to some receiver. And as we know in the Serac-Zola type scheme, we can transfer quantum information from one to the other. But there's a very simple master equation description of this in the limit where the delay time here is short. And you see that it involves some irreversible coupling between cavity A and cavity B. So I was very interested to know if that could be generalized to the fermionic case. And fortunately, it all goes through exactly the same, so long as you identify what the physics is. Of course, we don't have zero temperature baths like we do in quantum optics. We have baths at finite temperature. We have chemical potentials, which define the thermodynamic state of the baths. So typically, we'd have an ohmic contact with a ballistic channel running through another ohmic contact. A ballistic channel is one in which, to cut a long story short, the electrons just propagate like little billiard balls down the channel. The inelastic scattering length is much longer than the device. The phase scattering length is also much longer than the device. The things are at very low temperatures, so when an electron enters this channel, there are no states for it to scatter into, so it just travels ballistically down the channel. Then we have an exact analog of the system in quantum optics, where we have a double dot system and we can control the coherence here. We can have more dots, we can have time-dependent coupling fields in the tunneling, and we can do quantum control in this system. So let me conclude with this. Well, I won't go through the details. Essentially, you can derive the same master equation to describe this system, and again, we get coupling between the fermionic degrees of freedom in one dot and the fermionic degrees of freedom in the other dot, but of course, it's an irreversible coupling. So we can now imagine describing arrays of few solid-state qubit systems. We might have some hope of maintaining coherence in one or two or three quantum dot systems, and then use ballistic channels to control the information flow. And you could, for example, look at quantum repeaters in these systems in the same way that Peter Zoller and his co-workers have done. In fact, you could even imagine a molecular system in which the ballistic transport itself was carried out via carbon nanotubes, which can also exhibit ballistic conductance. I think I'd better stop there because it said 0 minutes. Thank you very much.
Can you comment on the gravity of Markov approximation?
Well, that is certainly a major problem in electronic systems because electrons, unlike photons, are very strongly interacting. So you have to very carefully analyze the validity of the Markov approximation. The master equations I'm writing down are all done in the Markov approximation, where I'm essentially only treating tunneling effects to lowest order in perturbation theory, so ignoring in these treatments co-tunneling and the like. That's because that is the sort of calculation I knew how to do. It'd be a very interesting exercise to go through and look at these cascaded systems in the other cases where you can't make perturbation theory to lowest order and you need to consider co-tunneling, but it's a very important and relevant issue in mesoscopic conductance, as are single electron charging effects, which I've also ignored in this description, but they could be included.
This problem of coupled fermion reservoir, you have the reservoirs affecting the electron on the dot, but from the point of view of reservoirs, it's switching on of a localized perturbation, and that we know it leads to extra divergences.
Right. Well, because I'm treating it as a reservoir, essentially I'm saying that there is something that maintains that reservoir in local thermodynamic equilibrium. So whenever an electron tunnels from the reservoir into the dot, the reservoir is instantaneously restored to local thermodynamic equilibrium by drawing charge in from an external circuit. So
the point
contact. There's no, in the point contact model, the interaction between the reservoirs and the dot is purely Coulombic. No electron actually enters the dot system from the reservoir.
The perturbation acts on the reservoir and must lead to infinite long response of the reservoir. And that's what X-ray singularities are. I'm just curious what.
Well, that is certainly possible in, if you sit down and analyze the dynamics in detail, of course, there are a number of complications of the sort you mentioned. In making the Markov approximation and describing the system, I've assumed that those effects are small. Now, of course, whether that's true in experimental context remains to be seen. We know they are there. My guess is if they are there, this is not a very good measuring device. Certainly, we've looked at single electron transistor devices where instead of having a point contact, we actually have an island here. And we know we have to operate in a very particular parameter regime where the Markov approximation is good for it to be a good measuring device at all. Otherwise, it's just a complicated, irreversible mesoscopic system. So I can't answer your question in detail. I am aware of the complications that arise in coupling between fermionic systems when the coupling is Coulombic. But I would suggest that for it to operate as a measuring device, we have to find a regime in which these particular kinds of descriptions are the most appropriate one.
What's your final conclusion with respect to the experimentalist? Is it better to
point of contact for a single electron transistor and RF
signal. Okay. In actual fact, I think it will always be better to use a radio frequency set, essentially to move away from low frequency noise due to charge states. If I'm trying to measure a very small charge transfer over, you know, a couple of hundred angstroms, then there are many sources of charge transfer on that scale between trap states, which will be pretty slow. So it will, I think, will be always appropriate, at least initially, to go to an RF set where you can move to higher frequencies and avoid those. Of course, it's a question of fabrication quality and oxide barriers and so on, so there's no in principle reason why a DC set or a point contact couldn't see these things, but I think it's a long way off before they actually do. In the very best situation, well, with the DC sets that we're building at the University of New South Wales, as well as the RF sets, the DC sets in principle would have sensitivity to see a partial transfer, a partial tunneling of an electron over a distance of 300 or 400 angstroms. We're pretty confident of that. But we know we won't see it because of noise coming from trap sites and so on. The RF sets that are used, for example, in the Cooper pair box qubits, do have the sensitivity to see single charge transfer on that level, and that's of course what we're attempting to duplicate.
The master equations really rest on two assumptions, the noise order prevention theory and the Markov transformation. Mm-hmm. Which of the two is the more questionable one in this
context? They're sort of tied together in an intimate way, but I think in the case of mesoscopic transport, it's the perturbation theory that's the most problematic. But once perturbation theory goes, then the Markov approximation itself becomes a little bit dangerous as well.
Is there a problem with frequencies when you move to condensed matter systems? The rotating wave approximation might not be valid in systems where it is in optimal systems?
Certainly that's true. Typically there are terms corresponding to Coulombic coupling, which are higher order than quadratic, for example, which you can't just ignore. In the simple tunneling systems that I've given, I haven't eliminated the free. I haven't gone to rotating wave approximation. The actual free dynamics is still in there. But in general, you wouldn't be able to make something like the rotating wave approximation. That's certainly true.
Okay, let's thank you.